Welcome to the COVID What Comes Next podcast with Dr. Ashish Jha, Dean of the Brown University School of Public Health and a globally respected pandemic scientist and physician. Every week here, Dr. Jha will analyze events of the previous several days and offer his assessment and guidance for what lies ahead. I'm your host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal and the USA Today Network.
Good morning, Ashish. How are you?
Hey, Wayne. Good morning. I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. So let's get right into what seems to be significant news. It broke overnight, literally overnight, shortly after midnight. And that's regarding AstraZeneca. And apparently there's a deep concern that they used outdated information to get to their 79% effective rate. Can you break that down for us?
Absolutely. Absolutely. A lot has happened on AstraZeneca over the last 48 hours. So we've all been eagerly awaiting the clinical trial results from the U.S. And it's mostly U.S. It's got some Latin American countries as well. And Monday morning early, they released results and they said that the vaccine was 79% effective against symptomatic disease and 100% against severe disease and no adverse events, no major adverse events. And we all saw that yesterday as fabulous news. And I spent a good time of day yesterday, Monday, talking about how terrific that was. And then late Monday night into early Tuesday morning, NIH puts out a statement saying that the Data Safety Monitoring Board told NIH, the company, et cetera, that the data in the press release used outdated data. Now, people may be thinking, like, what is going on here and what does all of this mean? So let me just share a couple of things with people so they understand how clinical trials work. The clinical trials work, there's a group running the clinical trial. And then there's a totally independent group called the DSMB, the Data Safety Monitoring Board. And they're made up of experts who have no connection to the company, whose only job is to look at the data and make sure that the clinical trial is being run well and reported well. And to me, I don't understand what happened. We need to hear a lot more from the company, but it just feels like an unforced error by the company. They should have gotten clear with the DSMB before they put out any press release. And, you know, I'll make two points as kind of big picture points. One is based on everything I have seen, Wayne. I think that the AstraZeneca vaccine is a very, very good vaccine based on everything I've seen. But this company has managed to mess up communication both with the public and with regulatory agencies over and over again. It's a bunch of incompetent people running the trial. Like, you got to get the facts and data right before you make it public. So it's been very frustrating because they're taking a good vaccine and they're tarnishing it, not because the science is bad, but because the communication is so bad.
So it seems to me that people reading this, learning this, who were hesitant about a vaccine to begin with might be further hesitant, saying, you know, look, this company gave outdated information, put out a press release. Do you have that fear that this could cause more people to say, yeah, forget it. There's just too many questions here.
Yeah, it doesn't help, right? Now, AstraZeneca is not authorized in the U.S., so this is an AstraZeneca problem. Johnson & Johnson didn't mess up its communication. Pfizer, Moderna have been really terrific. So the three vaccines that are authorized in the U.S. have not run into these issues. But I will be honest with you, like, AstraZeneca messing things up in this way doesn't help. It doesn't help people feel confident about their vaccine, and it doesn't help people feel confident about other vaccines. And this is why in a pandemic, when everything is under such scrutiny, you want to be particularly open and transparent, and you want to be very clear about things. And AstraZeneca has not taken that approach throughout the entire clinical trial. They've been messy and backtracking And again, as I said, I look at the underlying science and my take is the science underlying all of this stuff is very good, but their communication has been awful.
Well, it's unfortunate if it does have the effect of discouraging people from getting vaccinated with any vaccine, not just that one. And as you mentioned, it's not been approved for use yet in the U.S. Wanted to get into what some have called the second pandemic, the mental health pandemic, and that is the mental health implications of the last year when many people have been isolated, many people have lost their jobs, and there's been a sort of a cascade of events that are traumatic and stressful for people. maybe you can just sort of give an overview of how this affects people in the short term and long term. And I'm talking actually the general public, but also frontline workers who were, you know, so close to people suffering and dying.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of us have been very worried about this and about the whole pandemic. And I will tell you that we have only seen the tip of the iceberg. We've seen data on increases in substance abuse, more alcohol, more opioids. There's been a lot of weight gain. I mean, the weight gain obviously has direct health effects, physical health effects, but I think a lot of it is also due to mental health issues, anxiety, depression. And we are seeing the tip of the iceberg right now because people are still in kind of stress mode, get through this crisis mode. And we all know that we can get through a crisis by like just kind of hunkering down. But when that crisis abates, we are going to see this explosion of sentiment, but also effects on mood and affect. And so I am very worried that we are going to be dealing with the mental health ramifications of this for years and years and years. And, you know, I spoke to Congress about this a couple of weeks ago. And one of the points I made was we don't have the health, mental health workforce to manage what is coming. Right now, people are kind of, as I said, hunkering down. But as restrictions lift, as people start getting outside, as people start mingling and trying to go back to some semblance of normal, I think it's going to be very, people are going to realize how incredibly painful this year has been. And as I said, as a nation, I feel like we have little to no strategy for dealing with what will be a very substantial set of needs for the American people.
Do you have any optimism that such a strategy will be developed?
Yeah, I mean, states are going to have to do a lot. I think health systems are going to have to do a lot. I mean, it'd be nice to have stuff from the federal government, but you obviously can't, like, you know, produce a whole bunch of new mental health workers quickly. But I'm hoping that things like technology, telepsychiatry, telemental health stuff start helping. That is one of the upsides of this pandemic, is that we've figured out how to use technology more effectively. And I think it's going to fall on a lot of primary care providers who are going to see the effects of it directly in their clinic. People showing up with physical ailments and that are often manifestations of mental health challenges. So I've been talking to healthcare providers across the country and saying, you've got to develop a strategy now because you're going to be inundated in 3 to 6 months.
So what would you say to individuals who are experiencing some degree of crisis? And obviously in an emergency, you call 911. That's absolutely, you know, that goes without saying. But beyond that, people who may not be having an immediate emergency.
What I would say to people is you got to reach out. You got to reach out to your primary care provider. You got to reach out to a mental health provider. If you don't feel like you can, you got to start reaching out to family and friends. You would be surprised. And this is one of the things I've been trying to say to folks. You'd be surprised if you feel isolated, you feel anxious, you feel whatever you feel, depressed, down. You'd be surprised how many other people are feeling it too. And so the problem has been that this deep sense of isolation, we have everybody feeling isolated, and people just need to understand that their experience is not unique. It is fixable. It will get better, but it won't get better. For most people, it just doesn't get better naturally. You got to reach out and be proactive and connect with others. And once people start realizing that others are going through this and that there are ways of moving forward, that's going to be important. But getting help is step number one.
Thank you. So we had 3 audience questions. And the first is, if Dr. Jha is willing to address this, I wonder what he thought of Emily Oster's article in The Atlantic this week. And I think that was last week, titled, quote, "Your unvaccinated kid is like a vaccinated grandma." And you have said you're willing to answer that.
I am. I know Professor Oster well. I think she's brilliant. And I have three sets of points, I guess. One is, I hate the title. I wouldn't have, that's not, I don't like, again, the title, people have to remember this. When you write a piece and submit it to a journal, you don't get to pick the title. The editors pick the title.
Yeah, if I know that, believe me, from long experience.
I'm sure you do, Wayne, right? And people have to remember this. So people often get mad at me about titles of my paper, of things I've written. They're like, I hate your title. I'm like, I don't love it either. But editors get to do that. So let's go beyond the title, which I don't really love. She frames the conversation around, and she's really asking a narrow question, which is it safe to take kids out for vacation this summer? Can kids start socializing? Or as we all get vaccinated, do we keep kids socially isolated? That's her question. That's a really important question, right? Because adults are going to be vaccinated by May, June, but kids are not. So how do we treat kids? Do we just isolate them for another 6 months? And the mental health effects of isolation in kids has been horrible. And she says, look, kids don't get sick as often. And so you can almost imagine that their level of illness is not any worse than somebody who's a vaccinated older person. And therefore, don't worry about it so much and spend time with your kids and take vacations. I largely agree with her underlying point. Again, the framing got a little bit lost. And she says and admits that obviously kids can still transmit in a way that a vaccinated older person can't. And kids are not fully immune. But, if you reject the underlying point that she's making, then the question is, what are you going to do with your children? Are you going to really isolate them for another year? Say they can't have play dates. They can't go on vacations. They can't mingle with others. That strikes me as very, very detrimental. And I think we absolutely have to tolerate, my personal opinion, some level of risk in kids. Again, it's the virus is not that deadly in kids. And my hope is that the infection numbers get low enough that it's not going to be particular. There's not going to be a lot of risk of infection. But I thought she was trying to make a nuanced and important point, but it got lost in the title and some of the pushback.
Thank you. So this question comes from somebody who said, love the show. Thank you both all for what you do to spread factual guidance that is sorely needed. And that's really a compliment to you. I'm just the messenger, as it were. But here's the question. It seems fairly clear that all the approved vaccines in the U.S. will protect us from severe disease, hospitalization, and death. But what do we know about the vaccine and its protection from scenarios where mild or moderate COVID-19 leads to long COVID syndrome? And obviously, you know about that. And I've written about that, too.
Yeah, it's a very good question. And people often ask me about this is what do we know? And the short answer is we don't know a lot. We don't know a lot. But I will say this. We have not seen much in the way of long COVID symptoms in people who've gotten vaccinated so far. We haven't seen it in Israel. Now, again, the experience here is not very long lived. We haven't seen it in the clinical trials. Again, not a lot of people got infected, but some people did in the vaccine arm. And we have not seen any of them that I'm aware of develop substantial long-term complications or symptoms. So the short answer is I don't know. But my best guess is your chances of developing long COVID after you've been vaccinated and if you get a breakthrough infection is probably much lower. But I'm guessing there, and I don't want anybody to put too much weight on what I'm saying, but that's my best guess, that it's probably going to be pretty low likelihood of having long COVID. But we will have to see where the data takes us.
Final question. Based on the CDC guidance, we know a vaccinated person can be with another vaccinated person indoors and unmasked. We also know that a vaccinated person can be with a low-risk, unvaccinated person in the same manner. But what about the following two scenarios? A vaccinated person with kids who wants to resume social activities with other kids, and then a vaccinated person who lives with an unvaccinated person. And the first part of that you pretty much already addressed. But
yeah, the kid stuff is tough because, you could take the approach that not going to do it, and kids will need to be isolated for another probably 6 months or a year. And or if they do any socializing, it's always going to be outside with masks. I feel like that it's going to be up to people's choices, but I think that's going to be hard for a lot of people. And if, again, the community transmission numbers are low, I think trying to keep it, again, I wouldn't have a birthday party with 25 kids inside my house for 2 hours. Like, I'm not saying that would be okay. But I think I can imagine at a point where all the adults are vaccinated in summertime, could I imagine a kid over to visit one of my kids for a few hours and they spend a little time indoors? Yeah, I think that's fine. But that's a risk. It's not zero. So I that's how I've thought about this. The other part on the issue of what to do if you're a vaccinated person and you live with an unvaccinated person. If you're a vaccinated person, you can go out and socialize with other vaccinated people. The chances that you'll get the virus while vaccinated and then transmit it to an unvaccinated person is exceedingly low. Is it zero? No, it's not zero, but it's very, very low. So I would not worry about that excessively. Of course, I would encourage the unvaccinated person to get vaccinated because pretty much everybody can get vaccinated. But I think if you're a vaccinated person, the chances you're going to spread it to an unvaccinated person are very low. And that's why, in general, I wouldn't worry about it excessively.
Thank you, Ashish, for another great program. As always, if you have a question for Ashish, send it to gwmiller@providencejournal.com and write question for Dr. Ashish Jha in the subject field. Ashish, have a good day, a good week. We'll look forward to seeing you a week from now. We are fully in spring, and so that's a good thing.
It's a great thing. Spring is going to get better and better. We're not through the woods. We have a little bit of time to go. We've got some challenges in the next few weeks, Wayne, but I am looking forward to the rest of spring and summer. It's going to be great.
Take care.
Bye-bye.